The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show.
Good evening. I'm storyteller Otis Gyre, and I ain't your grandfather. From where I'm from, we don't do bedtime stories. And if that's what you were expecting, you're in the wrong place. If it's terrifying tales you're after, well then, I've got just the thing. Get comfortable. Settle in. Turn off the lights, if you dare. Your night is about to get a whole lot darker. Who needs sleep anyway?
Good evening. You're listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark. Welcome, dear listeners, to Season 15, Episode 2. I'm your host, Otis Gyre, and in this episode, I'll be performing two tales to terrify you, courtesy of authors Dale Thompson and Michael Mann. Tonight we'll hear stories of baleful burrowers and dangerous debauchery. Now, it's time to take a walk together down the moonlit trail. So lock your doors, turn your lights down low, and settle in. The show is about to begin. Ah! What's that on my arm? Oh, it's just a fly. Shoo, fly, shoo. There we go. You see, most of the time, insects are nothing to worry about. Usually, they're more scared of us than we are of them. Well, I did say usually, folks, because some people have no worse emotion than that caused by an ant on the ankle, a stink bug in the shoe, or a mantis in the... Well, you get the idea. Tonight, grid yourself and check to make sure your legs are bug-free, because chances are you'll be checking them once or twice during our excursions into terror. Dale Thompson brings us back to the weird and wonderful world of Dr. Victor Meunier, collector and seeker of the weird and unusual, who is regaling his longtime friends with yet another story of his dangerous exploits. Though he usually confronts more diabolical creations, he finds himself, in this instance, dealing with things with a few more legs than he's used to. Without further ado, I present to you The Mantis and the Doctor. The praying mantis. What a specimen. They are still, they are patient, with what could only be described as a mindfully relaxed nature. They're simply an insect with the power of divination and the fortitude to defend its territory even against the most formidable enemy. Beautiful but deadly. Cannibalistic, yet a spirit guide, a compass for lost, weary, wandering souls. With binocular vision, their compound eyes are suited and created to incapacitate and catch something as small and fast as a fly. Imagine a human with such a monoliform antenna and mandibles. The vertex of the head, some straight, others slightly convex. These insects are like the ancient ones with raptorial prothoracic legs. Each femur bears three series of spines near the claw furrow. It's easy to become attached to these prehistoric creatures with an emotional involvement insomuch as to seek their survival.
Marvelously speaking, they have wings, the female wings being the shortest. The wings of the male are much more functional for temporary flight. The mechanics and function are an aerodynamic wonder. The female uses her wings as a threat to menacing hungry predators, holding them at right angles to the body. Yet the male of the species is capable of taking flight with a twitching of the wings, gaining its center of gravity, and launching itself with winged rotation. Dr. Victor Meunier had entered the smoking lounge with a praying mantis attached affectionately to his evening jacket. This was peculiar even for the great doctor, to whom a group of us had attached ourselves to hear of his latest stories of travel, oftentimes meeting with paranormal escapades and unbelievable adventures. We four believed every word. My name's Theodore Fitton. I was in the listenership of Dr. Meunier. I never failed to come when invited to hear of his colorful chronicles. I, along with three others, Peter Blatty, Blake Plantain, and Roger Medford, were regulars at his exclusive private evenings. On this rare occasion, and I say rare because at times, we would go weeks without seeing the doctor due to his extended overseas trips to exotic and faraway places. He'd already met our acquaintance and welcomed us upon entering. Give us a brief introduction to whet the curiosity and build intrigue before delving into the details. I see the impressive and enigmatic perplexities in your eyes. I'm presenting first the visual before I begin my yarn tonight. After my most recent trip, I decided, based upon events that occurred over a two-week period, that these are indeed my favorite insect on the planet. I'm breeding and raising the mantis now. You might wonder why I would take on such a hobby. It's because of supernatural events that the mantis family rescued me from, as well as certain death. There was a small interruption in the doctor's vicissitudes as Miss Walworth, the doctor's sole caretaker and servant in the mansion, entered and quietly removed the praying mantis from the doctor before exiting appropriately through the servant's door in the back of the room. We saw very little of Miss Walworth and assumed it was intentional. The doctor protected certain parts of his life, even from us, whom he called his friends. Dr. Meunier took a seat across from us and asked, "Have you ever heard of a kissing bug or triatomines?" We looked at one another and shook our heads, indicating we had not. They're nocturnal insects that feed on the blood of mammals, including humans. They use their sharp beaks to puncture skin and suck small amounts of blood, much like a vampire. Not only is this painful for the victim, but in some cases, symptoms of an allergic reaction can occur with added complications. They can release parasites in the victims, and this can lead to further Chagas disease, which may be transferred to people and cause significant health issues, including premature heart disease, intestinal complications, and eventually death. I'm sharing this with you because I've had one hell of a time literally battling creeping and crawling insects straight from the fires below. As you know, my enemies have accumulated through the years, and in recent weeks they've joined forces in what, at the onset, look insurmountable. Yet I was given an early warning through an agent I pay handsomely. I have always said that it does not matter how much wealth and power one has accumulated through their lifetime. When the good Lord calls you home, regardless if you're an aristocrat, royalty, or achieved success as an entrepreneur, your time's up, and no amount of wealth can stop your light from being extinguished. I will say, my light has been very near snuffed on more than one occasion, and what I'm about to share with you is arguably the nearest I have ever been. Miss Walworth returned through the same door she had exited through, pushing a delightful tray of whiskies and cigars. This was a formality we would get out of the way and then continue through the evening while the doctor elaborated on his story. From the brands of whiskey and the perfectly rolled cigars, this was looking like a night to celebrate. "Thank you, Miss Walworth," Dr. Meunier said. She smiled pleasingly at him, and once again, she excused herself and slipped away. The doctor asked, "Where was I, man?" The doctor often sidetracked himself. I spoke up. "You mentioned life and death and insects." "Oh, thank you, Theodore," he said with a faint chortle, swirled his smoking cigar between his fingers, and continued. "It was 2 weeks ago, today, when I was confronted with a madman. At the time, I did not know him to be clinically insane because he was a colleague, and we shared some of the same interests. He was professionally mad, driven to madness rather than clinically mad. I want to die before I have to see another bug. That's the message that my friend sent to me, which drew me from my dwelling with extreme urgency to the coastal town of Bowes Castle in the southwest of England, northern Cornwall. There's a village there of whitewashed cottages and a supposed haunted hotel, which I looked into many years ago and found that the myth and the legend of the hotel were fabricated for tourism's sake. The acquaintance who sent me the message was Harold Ratcliffe, an entomologist who had amassed quite a collection of bugs and insects from all over the world. I had not heard directly from him in many years, so when I received such an odd message, I thought it best to take a road trip. I did not want to impose on him, but the message insisted I stay with him and, in his own words, deal with a matter of extreme urgency. This, too, was an unusual request because our mutual association at best was distant friends, hardly best mates. I was curious, so I accepted his invitation and set off for Cornwall. Harold didn't live in the village. He lived in an attractive two-story Victorian villa overlooking the sea. He had a modest acreage, but when I rolled up to it, I took note of how well it was groomed. It was very tidy, with stunning, uninterrupted views of the estuary. It was a commanding presence where it stood. I approached the house, and the front door immediately swung open. There stood a haggard Harold Ratcliffe, who did not properly greet me. Rather, he asked, "Did anyone see you drive in?" "To the best of my recollection," I said, "I don't believe so," and he proceeded to show me in. His home was all about his work. He had insect murals on the wall, bug statues and art pieces, even some odd lamps or two where the bases were of invertebrate nature. I decided to get right down to business. "May I ask, respectfully, why have you called for me? Not that I'm not flattered by the invitation, but I found some of the wording in your message hard to interpret and troubling." Harold offered me a seat and sat across from me, leaning in, hands clasped tightly together. I noticed a tenseness in his jaw, and his legs slightly shook like a flea-ridden dog. "I've lost control of my work. It's gotten away from me, and I may have opened a door that I'm unable to close. Some months ago, I was running a series of tests on some specimens, the parasite transmitted by a triatomine bug. I wanted to find out why exactly these nocturnal bugs bite around the mouth area while people sleep, and I had planned on looking into Chagas disease. However, my research was interrupted by a devilish thing. I thought I'd seen something from the corner of my eye, but when I turned, it was no longer there. On that particular evening, the perpetual manifestation occurred, and each time with the same result. I was unable to bring the black anomaly into full view. I stopped him there and said, "It sounds very similar to an event that happened to me some years ago. At this time, I carried on my person two stones for divine light called the Urim and the Thummim. Two onyx stones, grimoires, but in the end, I used a special camera to end my suffering." He seemed disinterested and continued, "There's more, much more. I believe this is beyond our world," Harold said with a slight tremble added to his nervous leg shake. "Please do continue," I urged him. I wanted to get to the bottom of this. Something dark had interrupted Harold's existence, and for him to have reached out to me must have been a last resort born out of desperation. I was actually down by the sea. I take walks to clear my head, and studying parasites can be an eye strain under the microscope. The very thing that had taunted me, that dark figure I saw in the corner of my eye, was standing straight ahead on the beach in a hellish gore, dripping with seaweed as if it had just taken a swim. I froze in my tracks. It was not my imagination. This was real. The probability that an otherworldly malignancy had entered our world and at Cornwall, of all places. Well, what are the odds? Astronomical, he stated, using a hypophora. I asked, was the dark thing standing like a man? It was cloaked, not revealing its true form, he answered. Unquestionably, this was proof that I was not going mad and that this thing existed. My fears were insurmountable, and with reluctance, I moved not a muscle because I wanted to know more. I was compelled to take a couple of steps backwards, but I stood my ground. I had not believed in omens. The idea of a portent of good or evil seldom crossed my mind, but this thing made me a believer in prophetic proof. I admit I was intimidated, but the temperament of the thing could not be measured. All of my superstitions came to fruition. Evidently, I had suppressed many childhood fears, and clearly, they had returned to paralyze me where I stood. The thing then dropped its infernal cloak, which was not a garment at all. It was a malefic, perverse shadow. This is when I saw the white cataractous eyes, which glowed with wickedness. This imposing man-sized arthropod, contorted in the most demoniacal spasm and shape. I saw it for what it was. It was a human-sized Zophorus, otherwise known as the ironclad beetle. It was, with due restraint, that my feet did not carry me home right away, but I remained most curious. A couple of inaccuracies struck me, other than the size of the armored bug. Astonishingly, these beetles are found in California, but never in England. Also, this one was standing upright, which is abnormal. Normally, only about an inch long and nearly indestructible, this enhanced bug standing before me, with its unsurpassed exoskeleton and its refined jigsaw puzzle-like shell, was an unrivaled, indestructible war machine. It was profanely reprehensible, a mockery toward nature, but at the same time, it was glorious. I stood amazed by its partially clad underbelly and fibrous, sinewed limbs. Muscle to bone and bone to bone, it resonated with power and strength. I used up the last ounce of my tenacity, attempting to remain composed, but I could not bear to view the ghoulish cyclopean any longer. So I ran for my life, blundering away under unsteady legs, believing I was in harm's way. By the time I'd made it home, I was thoroughly exhausted, desperately panicked and baffled that something like this could exist. Within moments of arriving, completely expended of energy, I practically collapsed through the door. I unceremoniously and quickly locked it and barricaded myself in the bathroom. Why I chose the bathroom is beyond me, but I felt safe. Maybe because it was like putting more walls between me and that flightless beetle. In the bathroom, crouched down, the chattering outside started, which I knew was the chthonic monster clicking its mandibles and hissing loudly. There were many sounds invading my home. It was horrendous. Thereupon, Harold stopped describing his traumatic event and looked to me as if he believed I held the answers. I had no answer, but I had a plethora of questions. What unusual or questionable experiments were you performing right before you encountered this behemoth of a beetle? I am ashamed to profess, moreover, confess to certain questionable practices that I have indulged in subsequent days. You know the reputation of our town and the association with witches and the occult, I presume. I answered, of course. This is England's Salem. We have, of course, the Museum of Witchcraft here, and I know the curator well. He indulged me upon request, and I was permitted to delve into an edition of Demonology from the King James section, and within it I became associated with incantations, omens, and familiar spirits. I know I should have never given myself to such hellish temptation, but my work had stalled. It was by researching the cytoplasm of various animals that I discovered a connection between terrestrial arthropods and alien supernatural characters. Science had dismissed demons many years ago, mainly due to Louis Pasteur finding that germs were responsible for such conditions like rabies, and thus sniffing out the quintessential reasoning for rabies, which people believed at the time to be demon possession. One does not inherit such a virus as rabies, which attacks the brain and nervous system, but can they pass down a demon? Even today, medicine is primitive and diseases are treated rather than cured. I'm convinced these familiar spirits are partially responsible in matters of disease and madness. I see the two inextricably interwoven, and this led me back to my studies on Chagas disease. Where are the dwelling places of these demons, these parasites, when they're not inflicting dread upon their victims? I believe that before the Anglo-Saxons took all of the lands from the indigenous people, spirits were not maleficent like we see today. Spirits, according to some tribes, lived in trees or rivers and were benevolent as long as they were not provoked. Man vexed himself by stirring up the evil that had laid dormant. I've dabbled, and thus I believe I've stirred up a familiar spirit or spirit of insects, and now they've arisen seeking retribution. I am predestined for death. Harold sighed and dropped his head. That was a tempting process, what he had just shared with me, but to be honest, the last I heard anyone saying they were predestined for death was when I infiltrated an Afro-Cuban Yoruba cult a very long time ago, and this spirit, Biku, went after children. This deity of death proved to be a legend only. Harold was truly confused in his evaluations and now believed himself imprisoned, as is written by the ancient Hebrews. They lay in their own houses, prisoners of darkness, fettered in bonds of a long night. I responded with, "I do not see the correlation." Harold seemed offended. He lifted his head, drew a deep breath, and said sententiously, "They must invariably be connected. These demons, or contagions, devour the humanity within a host. It's a total embodiment of the soul at a certain point, and this is when the body becomes incurable," Harold passionately expressed. "Tonight, we'll return to the sea where you saw this beetle and let us see if it manifests again," I suggested. A look of pale terror came upon Harold's face, as if all of the blood had left his body. He was truly afraid. His disinclination was obvious. I could see he struggled with his mannerisms, his thoughts, and the notion of returning to the spot he described was intolerable for him. "I'm not looking for validation in my discovery. This thing has plundered my heart. I can still feel it gnawing at me. I need to know how to exterminate it. I've let it out of the box, and I do not know what it is capable of. Beelzebub is the fly god. He breeds insects by the power of the sun. What if I've invited this entity into our world?" I attempted to conjecture logically, composed, without arrogance or dispute, but I could not disguise my concern. There was a certain truth to be believed in this statement and in his actions, but I needed to see for myself if he'd invoked a devilish fiend, and we were now susceptible to formidable swarms of his venomous subjects. "Do you think I'm imagining things?" he tearfully asked me. "I believe you saw something, but I also believe it's possible your imagination could be playing tricks on you. You did say you had hit a roadblock and had sought out means to continue your research, outside of what I would consider set parameters for your work and studies. Maybe, and I will not say with certainty, but could you be stressed, overworked, and could have experienced a psychotic episode on the night in question?" Decisively, he answered, "No, I saw what I saw, and it was real." "Come, take a look at this," he said, rising from his chair. I followed him outside, weeding our way through the tall grasses until he pointed at the back of his house. "How does one protect himself from that?" he asked. The back exterior wall had been dug into by something sharp and shredding. Part of the wall had calcified in fibrous red cysts, and some were leaking, causing a painted drip effect. The left-hand side of the wall had undefined scattered crimson stains, or maculation. I longed to take a sample back to my own library for analysis, but I had arrived ill-prepared for such clinical work. There was no denying the evidence, and without exception, I swore to him that we would get to the bottom of this. That night, after the sun had melted behind the sea and the night twinkled with dazzling stars, Harold agreed to take me to the exact place of his encounter. It was initially objectionable, but I convinced him that he was the most prevalent character in all of this. I didn't unequivocally believe this to be true. I knew little or nothing about bugs, but I had a wealth of knowledge of demonology. I needed to see the giant insect for myself in order to be absolutely convinced and determine if it was from this world or if it was indeed of extraterrestrial origin. Armed with flashlights for sight and protection, though if this thing was down there by the sea, we were confronted by what he had described, any sort of offense or retaliation would be futile. We walked a fair way until Harold, who was leading, stopped cold. "It was right there, where I'm shining my light," he told me. I walked past him because it seemed as though he had no plans of walking further. I shined my light down at the sand and the rocks, but there was no obvious evidence of anything out of place. "There's nothing here to find," I informed him with a shout because we were now some distance apart. He said something more or less unintelligible. He looked abstracted. Incidentally, to prove I was taking him seriously, I palpated the sand with my hands, pretending to be looking for something to excavate. Then I saw the sand just out of my reach shifting. It was caving in on itself. Regretfully, I feared I likely had disturbed something sleeping beneath the sand. "We might have something here, Harold," I shouted out bitterly over the sound of the lapping waves. I stood upright from my kneeling position. Many unpleasant-looking worms began to surface in full view. I took a few steps back toward Harold. It was immediately apparent that these worm-like creatures were not a natural occurrence. The worms were wiggling with intent and driving me backward. Harold began his staggered retreat, twisting around to look back a couple of times as he increased his stride. Squirming marine monsters had small crinoid limbs spread along their snakish underbellies, helping to propel them along, and were moving at a fast crawl with every flex of the muscle, sliding and slipping through the sand. I believe these were the feared bobbit worm. These creatures were springing forward, lurching from the sand like coiled springs, snapping their ferocious mouths with chomping sounds, ready to devour flesh down to the tooth-studded throats. Those throats, which sickeningly turned inside out in protraction and retraction movements, aimed toward their prey, which so happened to be the two of us. I had known these to be underwater creatures, not adaptable to land pursuits. However, everything I had ever learned about them, I seemed to have been mistaken about, because we were being pursued at a rapid rate in their attempts to girdle either of us in a python grip. I threw out all conceptions of what was known to me for the time being and acted on pure intuition. These benthic worms, with their weaponized jaws wider than their own exposed bodies, attempted to sting us over and over again and take us by the ankles. Their slimy bodies were leaving an unpleasant trail of mucus through the sand. They were far more offensive than anything that could be produced by a demon's bowels. They were splitting apart with multiplying rapidity, but thankfully, we were now at Harold's house. We surged inside and slammed the door. Poor Harold made a move for the bathroom, but I wasn't convinced that would stop this invasion if their intention was to enter the house. They could easily breach our defenses. I was perplexed, and nothing was coming to mind to rescue us, if indeed we needed rescuing. Sounds of gelatinous liquid dripped from the roof, smacking heavily on the ground, which meant the worms had now engulfed the home and secretions were being released through the sebaceous glands of the worms. And then I thought, the answer's in the book. Harold! I yelled through the bathroom door, where Harold was shaking like a leaf on a tree. Where's the book? I needed that demon book he had dabbled in. The situation was more than likely caused by the book, so it could be resolved within the book. Harold poked his head out of the bathroom and, with a brief injection of courage, said, I'll get it for you. You'll never find it. Harold, in a mad dash, bolted from the bathroom like the house was on fire and disappeared into one of the back rooms. I could hear corpulent globs of gunk now rolling off the roof of the house, the gelled lumps splattering on the ground outside. I hoped the roof would hold up under the writhing pressure. Harold returned, holding the book close to his chest inseparably. I snatched it from him with no time to spare. I was not familiar with the book, so it would be like a needle in a haystack. Then I found exactly what I was looking for on page 43. I read from the book. This was a two-person conversation of one Philomathus and Epistemon, neither of which I was familiar with. Philomathus. Yes, there are sun-dried spirits that affirm to have haunted such places, where these spirits are alleged to be, and could never hear or see anything. Epistemon. I think, well, for that is one lie reserved to the secrete knowledge of God, whom he will permit to see such things and whom not. Philomathus. Where these spirits haunt and trouble any houses, what's the best way to banish them? Epistemon. By two means may one lie the remedy of such things be procured. The one is ardent prayer to God, both of these persons that are troubled with them, and of that church whereof they are. The other is the purging of themselves by amendment of life from such sins as have procured that extraordinary plague. Philomathus. And what means, then, these kinds of spirits, when they appeared in the shadow of a person newly dead, or to die, to his friends? Harold screamed out, What does it mean? To be honest, it sounded to me like a simple repentance of practicing witchcraft. But I wondered if Harold even knew what he had already done. He seemed oblivious to the magnitude of spiritual crimes he had made committed. There's nothing I could do. This was the first time in my many years of battling the forces of darkness that I had no solution, no backup plan, and felt out of my depth. I was literally unqualified for the undertaking. Dr. Meunier, as he often did at the climax of his stories, paused the stories and asked us in attendance, Would you care for a bite to eat? A different drink? Anything? The four of us were always anxious for him to get on with the telling of the story, and we politely informed him that we were fine and set for the night, if he would please continue. Very well, he mused. Where was I? Roger reminded him, You found the book and had no solution. That is it, the doctor confirmed, and being reestablished in place, he started again to share his story. Harold was terribly frantic. Was pacing the floor, and his hands were fidgety. He had good reason to be worried because the unimaginable was upon us. The inner walls were showing stress cracks from the sheer weight of the frothing, ever-expanding ooze we could see spilling down the windows. Harold bent at the waist, his stomach clenched in sickness, and his face looked bloated as if he were going to burst. The noises of slithering, then constricting and stickiness, causing snaps, slurps, pops, and sucking, filled our ears. I could not be sure the radius that had been affected around the house, but indisputably, the house simply was not going to hold this weight. Harold, are you a praying man? I asked, because in situations such as this, prayer maybe should have been the first resort instead of the last. No, I'm afraid my skills of reaching a divine being are underdeveloped. I suggest you find your spirit, inner self, because you're the only one who can appease our attackers. Harold seemed to be withering quickly, and in his state of confusion and mental anguish, he plainly said, God help us. That was not really helpful, and of no use or consolation, and if we were not about to meet our devise, it would have been comical. But under this dire circumstance, I found nothing humorous in this pathetic cry. This was when I noticed that small, creeping things with pinchers clacking had burst through an air vent in the ceiling, and it began to rain down saffron-colored, hand-sized crustaceans with yellow, annular-shaped markings on their shell backs. These were of no invertebrate animal that I could specify. The tips of their pinchers were vibrant green, almost translucent, like a luminance that flickered from a light bulb, not in the socket completely. Their mouths, as best as I could see, protruded from their head and were filled with a copious amount of razor teeth. There was a violent, ciliated orbit, which I can only describe as a rudimentary cyclopean eye, placed in the center of their heads. Harold ran toward me and, using me cowardly as a shield to make distance between him and the scampering aquatic arthropods, as much as his lily-livered antics indisputably and unashamedly were exposed. I cannot say I blame the man. He had no fight in him, and it was looking as though the two of us were about to be ran over. Quickly thinking, I swung open the door to the broom closet, and luckily there was a broom standing in the corner. I commandeered it, the broom, with my right hand and shut the door with my left. I thought, possibly, if I could use the broom to push back the invaders while making a dash for the back door, we stood a chance. In an act of exhilarating desperation, I began sweeping the room back and forth across the floor, pushing the attackers to one side, then the other. Some attached themselves to the bristles of the broom and attempted to make a climb upward along the handle to reach my hands. Even though their pinchers clicked together to hold on, I was surprised to find that the manufactured nightmarish crayfish with their crusher claws were no match for the power of the broom. Once we reached the door, the time for caution and hesitation was over. I opened the door with deliberate force, and together, the two of us charged out into the night, immediately stepping in wet, pasty puddles of mucilaginous adhesive. Whatever the substance was, incredibly, it covered the entire backyard, creating a soggy, oily, spongy sprint, squishing all the way to the main road that led into town. Our shoes were very slippery, and each step we took had to be thought through. The iridescent gunk clung to the soles of our shoes, and we tried to shake off the gloppy mess. The bottoms of our long pants were smeared with the caked on, quickly hardening liquid marrow. Standing at a distance from Harold's home, we could now see the full scale of the globular attack. His house gleamed under moonlight, encased entirely now with a thick, jelly-like substance. As far as demon creatures, I did not see any. I could only imagine the house was crawling with the cold-blooded monsters. As much as I would like to announce our plight was over and we were safe, the unexpected happened. The glittering, frostily tiled roof of Harold's house caved in, and the rest of the house followed, collapsing in on itself, destroying not only his life of work, but burying the demonology in the rubble. Harold groaned with vociferated curses. His loss was the least of our worries, though. I observed something disturbing. There was a shuffling taking place amidst the pile of wood and lumber. Although I believed we were at the safe distance, I could plainly see a mounting collection of legless white larvae emerging from the destruction, rolling off the pile of heap onto the ground. They began to crawl like a clumsy army, but the closer they advanced, they indelibly transformed under the Stygian sky, advancing with hideous mutations, changing their shapes. The greater they metamorphosized from their grub state, the more I could see a new manifestation of winged fire ants. The alteration to their genetic structure was fascinating to watch, and aroused me in a great interest, but the unfathomable lengths to which this plague had grown was the real issue at hand. Harold did not have time to wallow in self-pity and bode over his diminishments. He should have been wrapped by the hysteria building in me and the reproductive flight that was taking shape. I had certainly had enough and was ready to bolt for town on foot. There must have been thousands of festering ants, as if a nest had exploded and mobilized from a colony into a potential swarm. Now would be a good time for a giant can of fly spray, I said. The ants were not the average biting kind. These had hornet-style stingers, and I understood they were coming for us. Harold collapsed in his weakness, and I could not pry him from the ground. He was beside himself, floundering mentally, with unaccountable grief and crying out, "Forgive me, forgive me! I'm sorry, I was wrong!" He was wholly engrossed in fear, and spoke of terrible hypotheticals out loud of our impending doom. He imagined the seven vials of wrath from the Book of Revelation, Armageddon and killer angels, and speculated upon the apocalypse, abstracted from the environment he was now facing. I could not make sense of him. This was a prayer or a pusillanimous plea from insect mercy. Regardless, my eyes were riveted upon the scourge with intense scrutiny. Swarm was collecting itself, preparing for an imminent attack. Their bodies buzzed and flaked thin, scaly layers away like weightless confetti. The last of their puppy skin had shed, and now they were covered with a light brown layer of filmy glazed membrane. Despite the almost certain fact that hell was soon to be unleashed, my eyes instinctually diverted away when I heard a unique sound of a certain definite vibration that I'd never heard before. I could not begin to imagine what other mortal danger was coming our way. The sky over my shoulder was clotted with what I imagined at first to be dragonflies, but as it moved closer, it was a supersedure larger swarm of praying mantis. The angelic specimens were descending rapidly. Was this another portent? A sign that our demise was close at hand? I could not be sure if this was a good omen or a bad one. Not until they soared right above our heads, straight over us like a ball of fire, with a deafening roar, and engaged the swarm of flying red ants before they were assembled to launch their assault. The praying mantises were a godsend. Maybe the heavens had heard Harold's abysmal petition, but it was neither here nor there because the mantis struck with deadly force and precision. The sky was humming with an ear-splinting buzzing, a cacophony of droning vibrations and a whirring sound of victory and death. Because of the late hour, we saw little of the war that raged, but it didn't take long for the thrumming to filter out, and all was silent except for the distant waves of the sea crashing up on the shore. The doctor's story was over, and we sat in stunned silence. "Well, gentlemen, that's the reason for the praying mantis that I introduced tonight. I now value the mantis as a portent of good news far above any other living creature at the moment, for if they had not gathered to rescue Harold in that hue of fire, and this dark omen had bled itself out and had not been restrained, it could have spread as an infestation, an unstoppable contagion even across England and possibly all of Europe." Peter Blatty, who had remained quiet throughout the story, asked, "What about Harold? What happened to the poor fellow?" The doctor said, "It's reputed that Harold salvaged some of his work and has tried to pick up where he left off in his research, minus the demonology and witchcraft sources he foolishly leaned on. But do not allow me to misrepresent poor Harold. We were met with more than a formidable foe. These will be remembered as endearing, formative days in which we both nearly lost our lives. One's demise is hardly a thing to scoff at. Harold survived, as well as I, and we independently used our survival means, regardless of how different they may have been. I think in some regards we showed equal doggedness, even as it manifested differently between us. Blake Plantain had remained seated, also quiet until this moment, when he inquired, "As to the demonology, the book that seemed to have been the source of the dread and blight, what became of it?" The doctor slyly smiled and answered with a question, "What becomes of all great artifacts I stumble across in my travels?" We knew what he meant, for Dr. Victor Meunier was a collector of all things weird, strange, and unexplained. I hope you enjoyed The Mantis and the Doctor by Dale Thompson, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed the tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented featured author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Dale-Thompson. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/Dale-Thompson. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. Sometimes, the only way to deal with a bug is with another one. I brought in a few dermestid beetles once to take care of some slugs in my backyard. Turns out dermestids don't care much for slugs, but do like to nibble on old bits of meat. Needless to say, they're still very welcome in my backyard, but for, well, very different reasons. Michael Mann brings us our second story of the evening, of an unpleasant brute of a man with a bit of a drinking problem, though after he finds an interesting bottle of alcohol, drinking may not be the worst of his problems soon enough. Take heed, though, dear listener. Those of you who feel a bit queasy about the juicier side of insects might want to go in a little forewarned. Without further ado, I present to you, Don't Drink the Worm. And then I told her if she didn't like it, she could get out. Scooter shouted to the group, recalling the last moments of his latest failed relationship. If I'm going to drink, goddammit, I'm going to drink. Ain't nobody telling me what I can do. He motioned his hand to his beard, drenched in beer foam. Ah, she's getting on my nerves anyway. All I need is my hand, he cackled, and the men surrounding him joined in. Skeeter Duckett, local masonry repairman and jack of all trades, but master of none. He was born and raised in this small town, and his reputation was as large as his tolerance for alcohol. His liver was made of iron, and the man drank from morning to night. He frequented the bar that was located roughly 2 blocks from his rundown trailer. Somehow, he managed to stay there, drinking until he was thrown out around 3 in the morning and still made it to work on time. Replacing brick and mortar was the main profit of his income for the company that regretfully hired him. Beyond those 10-hour shifts, he would sometimes replace drywall or pour concrete, depending on the request, but it all depended on his motivation. Local handyman and town drunk all rolled into one. He was not hired because he was the best or because his work was perfection. He was hired for the price, cheapest around, and often did the side jobs for a few bottles of whiskey or a 30-pack of beer, whatever he could get to fill his gullet. He was rude, obnoxious, and a womanizer. No relationship lasted longer than a week, and it was always due to his drinking habits or lack of hygiene. The last victim of his punch-drunk love left only after 4 days. Skeeter cared not for the loss and went about his days continuing to piss away his money. The townsfolk humored him simply for the cheap labor and the avoidance of his other side. If he ever got angry, then all hell would break loose. He was no stranger to the police station's drunk tank and would periodically spend a weekend sleeping off whatever alcohol-fueled rage he'd suffered from. Blackouts, ending with bloodied lips and shattered glass down at Gino's bar, happened more frequently than the owner liked. Skeeter was an all-out mess, and the town dealt with him like you deal with that annoying cousin you're forced to hang out with during Thanksgiving. He didn't really have friends. Those who were seen in his company were more like acquaintances that got suckered into his never-ending tales of bullcrap. But if anyone stuck around long enough, he'd reach a point of intoxication that he'd start buying whoever was near him free drinks. However, if they left too early or didn't laugh at his jokes, then the rage would surface, and that's when he'd lose control. A big man, almost 7 feet tall and a good 300 pounds. He had a beer belly, but underneath it was pure muscle from decades of hauling brick and mixing mortar. He was not one to toy with, and this added to the tolerance of everyone who lived in this small town. The company Skeeter worked for only consisted of 6 men and was run by 2 others, a family-owned business that had been around for a good 80 years. Their work was not the greatest, and Skeeter was at the bottom of that totem pole, but he claimed to be the best mason of them all. His mortar joints were never packed tight, which left holes and bricks cracking. When he laid brick, it was always crooked because he refused to use the level, and when mixing up mortar, it was always too wet to do anything with. So he was banned from the mixing box for life. He was the 2nd longest-running journeyman there, but the younger guys could run circles around him. But with his temper, they had to pretend to be slow at their job, only correcting his mistakes when he walked away or wasn't paying attention. Once again, his reputation was the only thing that kept him on the payroll. The boss man tried to fire him once, and that turned into the man being sent to the hospital with a broken jaw and his company truck being left on blocks. Skeeter was a force to be reckoned with, and no one had the balls to go toe-to-toe with the man. Even when he was caught stealing out of the homes he did repairs on, no one said a damn thing. After finishing the latest job of cutting and repointing the brick walls of the local library, Skeeter made a discovery. There was a section of brick that had fallen thanks to his overpowering force while using a chipping hammer. Everyone else used angle grinders to remove the outdated mortar joints, but Skeeter refused to ever use them. He would rather bust it out with force than be covered with mortar dust, ironic considering his bathing habits. His refusal to use the proper tools and destroying projects was a constant problem, and the company would have to do extra work not added to the contract in order to fix Skeeter's screw-ups. When he hit between the brick too hard, a good section fell and revealed a wooden wall behind. Bricks tumbled to the ground and a cloud of dust invaded the air. After the haze settled and Skeeter calmed his coughing fit, he saw old worn-out planks crudely placed within the inner wall. The wood smelled of moss, and there was a scent of something dead. The area was very small and crooked, like the wood had been crudely shoved into an old cement section of the inner wall while it was still wet. There was a rusty latch that held a small door closed, and he opened it without hesitation. It was a secret cabinet of some sort, resembling a stash spot from the olden days. The library was a renovated building that used to be a speakeasy during the Prohibition era, staged as a diner, and this looked to be a secret edition made for hiding. Well, the evidence was there when Skeeter pulled out a dusty bottle filled to the neck with a brackish liquid. There was no label of any kind, and it was the only thing in the small crevice. He said nothing to anyone and stashed the bottle in his work bucket, placing it gently inside so as to avoid any of his tools cracking the glass. He planned to take it home and drink it after work. No sense in wasting alcohol, and if it was truly that old, it would be strong enough to get him drunk. He relayed the brick over the spot in such a manner that, unknown to him, the guys came back the next day on Saturday to relay the horribly crooked section. When he made it home, he sat down and removed his boots. The stench of his feet made his eyes water a bit, but after a while, the smell settled and it no longer bothered him. He grabbed the TV remote and pressed the button to turn it on, sitting in his slowly rotting leather chair. Nothing happened, and he sat, looking at the reflection in the black box in front of him.
"Oh, goddammit!"
he yelled out loud, spit flying from his mouth and falling onto his disheveled beard. He ran outside barefoot toward the generator that sat behind the trailer. He poured gas into it until the hole overflowed. He gripped the makeshift wooden handle and pulled it until it growled to life, sending an obnoxious rattling sound that echoed through the trees beyond. He walked back inside and sat down while catching his breath and pushed the button, and the TV turned on this time. Skeeter didn't pay for electricity, but instead ran a generator that was specifically used for the TV, microwave, and box fan. There was also no running water, which left the man smelling atrocious most of the time, but on occasion he'd buy a few jugs of water to wash his hair and balls in anticipation of a conjugal visit. Aside from that, he had a kerosene lamp he used for light and a cooler packed with ice for his beer and lunch meat. But he would have no problem drinking the beer hot, either. Ice-cold beer was a fancy delicacy, so normally his drink was warm like piss. He put on some college football game and pulled the old bottle from his bucket to further examine it. The glass of the bottle was a foggy white, and the liquid inside was dark brown with a tint of gold. He sloshed the contents around, and something rose toward the top of the bottle, whirling in the now mini-vortex of aged liquor. Skeeter examined it. "What is that?" A small white form with yellow and green spots swayed within. A worm. "Well, we've got some tequila tonight." He attempted to open the bottle, but it had rusted with its metal cap, and it refused to budge and sliced his hand. In a fit of rage, he slammed the bottle down, but it didn't break. He rummaged through his tool bucket until he found a pair of vice grips. "I'll get you open, you sumbitch." He made quick work of the rusted metal and brought the opening of the bottle to his nose. He took a deep inhale and bile rose from his stomach as the nose hairs singed. "This ain't no tequila, but goddamn it's strong." Skeeter was completely out of alcohol in his cooler and was feeling very lazy, refusing to leave the trailer. Finding the bottle was a godsend, even if it was old and smelled like pure gasoline mixed with rubbing alcohol and a smidge of sewage. He looked at the bottle and watched the small white cylindrical object descend to the bottom. Without thinking, he took a long drink from it, and when the contents hit his taste buds and flowed through his throat, it burned like the fires of hell, and his eyes began to water. "God damn!" Skeeter began to cough uncontrollably. The taste was like nothing he'd ever experienced. There were hints of spiced rum, Everclear whiskey, and oddly enough, chili pepper. Like taking multiple shots and biting into a spicy bowl of canned chilies. After wiping his eyes and blowing his runny nose into a rocket of snot that splattered on the floor, Skeeter took another long drink. The exact same thing happened, but this time he could taste copper along with the burn of a ghost pepper. Did they make this with scraps of veggies and leftover shots? Skeeter had a tendency to talk to himself when he was alone. He paused to roll up a cigarette from the leftover butts in the ashtray in a rolling paper. After twisting the paper and lighting one end with a match, he looked at the bottle. A burning sensation was stirring in his stomach that caused it to rumble. He hadn't eaten all day and searched the cooler for something to snack on. Skeeter moved his hand through the lukewarm water at the bottom and grabbed a bag. Inside were two slices of warm bologna. Without any consideration of the consequences, he ripped open the bag and inhaled the meat. With something in his stomach, Skeeter brought the bottle back to his lips and took another long drink. The essence of fermented vegetables and a bit of its potency left snot running out of his nostrils. More coughing echoed inside the trailer, followed by screaming. "God damn! Every time this stuff kicks my ass!" He was both dumbfounded and excited by the reaction his body had with the alcohol. There was no doubt this stuff was old, and the age of it had created a concoction strong enough to remove paint. By this time, he'd already consumed half of the bottle. He gazed inside, and looking at the floating white shape that did not move unless the liquid was disturbed, Skeeter remembered hearing about certain tequila brands that had a small worm in it, and there were rumors that if you ingested it, you'd hallucinate. "What can you make me see?" Skeeter addressed the worm that was spinning in the bottle as he swayed it in his hand. The liquor was kicking in. That warm, fuzzy sensation was taking over, and the world began to spin. A few more swallows, and soon all that was left was a bit of liquor mixed with backwash, and the little white shape settled at the bottom. With one eye fixed on the sad creature, Skeeter held it up to the flame of his lantern and spoke in a drunken slur. "Well, bottoms up." He chuckled under his breath, burping a bit with the sting of acid reflux rising from his stomach. He brought the bottle up, and in a single gulp, Skeeter finished it off and swallowed the grubby wormhole. The burning of the random peppers sent a flurry of fluids expelling from multiple parts of his body, and the man ended up pissing himself before falling asleep. Drool and snot left a long, slimy trail in his beard that became crusty as time passed and the sun rose. Skeeter woke up the next day feeling like pure crap. That entire weekend, Skeeter felt the repercussions of drinking an old bottle of alcohol he found stashed in the walls of an old building. Needless to say, his side job was canceled. He was sweating nonstop, and every 10 minutes he was running outside to dump in the woods. Being that he never paid for water, the plumbing in his trailer was completely useless. He headed to Gino's bar later that night, but his stay there was short-lived after he had puked all over a table and crapped his pants, forcing the owner to throw him out. His body was weak, so there was no fighting the eviction, and he just stumbled his way back home. Sunday night was spent with Skeeter staying on his dirty mattress and sweating off the alcohol. He never got a full amount of sleep. Every few hours, he woke up to either vomit, piss in a bottle, or run to the woods to paint a tree with his feces. At one point, he had no dime to run outside and was forced to use his non-functioning toilet. After he finished, Skeeter felt a strange sensation in his right eye. He continued to rub it in order to remove the sensation, but it did no good. So he went to the cooler, filled a cup with warm water, and took it to the bathroom. Under the light of a kerosene lamp, he stood in front of the mirror and used the water to ease the weird feeling. It burned, but it was itchy, as if something was digging at it. He took a closer look at his eye, and it was bloodshot, and the bottom lid was being swollen. He pressed at it, and pus oozed out and fell into the sink. He looked at what fell from his eye, and the small spot began to shift. "Huh?" Skeeter mumbled as he brought the lamp closer to the sink. At the bottom was a glob of yellow pus, and inside something was moving. Looking back at the mirror, he saw more oozing out to fall toward the sink. He panicked and splashed water on his face and did his best to flush out the eye. He pressed hard on the swollen lid until every drop of the infected liquid expelled and into the drain. He looked again, and the swelling was gone, but the blood vessels in his eyes had busted in multiple areas. He rubbed at it to ease the burn, but it did nothing. Skeeter became frustrated. "Oh, screw this. I'm going to bed." He dumped the rest of the water in the sink, and he watched all the disgusting pus flow down. He stopped when he saw multiple white things wriggling around into the water, but they fell to the darkness of the drain before he could get a full examination. He let out a fart and stomped his way back to bed, not looking forward to the first day's week of work. Monday morning, Skeeter struggled to get up and move. He was groggy as hell and drenched in sweat. The wind from the fan hit his wet and slimy back, causing a chill to run up his spine. He jolted up to avoid the cold, standing up and stretching his arms until his palms pushed up against the ceiling. He walked toward the kitchen sink and let his bladder loose to flow down the drain, scratching at multiple areas of his body. He scooped up more water from the cooler and dumped it into the sink to avoid the lingering scent of urine. He stumbled back to his room and started to get dressed. He threw his shirt on the bed and searched the floor for his pants. After he put his pants and boots on, Skeeter reached for the shirt on his bed and paused after grabbing it. In the spot where he slept was a large wet area, and in the center was a pile of something white that moved. He crept closer and strained his eyes to see what the white form was. He yelled when he realized what he was looking at.
What in the hell? What is that?
Upon closer examination, he knew he was looking at a pile of worms, shifting and rolling around in his sweat-drenched mattress. They were more like maggots, white pulsating forms littered with yellow and green dots. They look exactly like the one in the bottle that he'd swallowed whole. Skeeter stood in silence, unsure of how to process this. The small pile began to expand and spread over the wet spot. Small squishing sounds could be heard in the silence. In a panic-stricken rage, Skeeter stomped on his bed. His foot bounced up and down with the spring, sending some of the grub-like worms to fly in the air, while others became a smooshed mash of yellow and black ichor. He continued until nothing remained of their original forms. Afterward, he grabbed a rag and attempted to scoop up the mess and throw it outside. He'd deal with the stain later when he came back. He was running late and had to rush to work. The drive there, all he could see were those disgusting things moving around in his bed, and he began to dry heave. Areas of his arms burned, and he had to swap which hand held the steering wheel so he could scratch them. All day, he did his best not to think about the worms and focus on repointing the foundation blocks of the municipality building. But the periodic burn of his skin was beginning to piss him off, and he kept having to pause his work and dig his disgusting nails into his flesh. That feeling somehow coincided with what he saw in his bed and eventually led him to be thinking about the bottle he found. Soon his stomach began to act up, and he was left jumping off of the scaffolding to run to the port-a-john. Skeeter burst into the plastic facility and, in haste, dropped his pants and let loose. "God damn it!" he yelled as he felt the burn of hot magma shoot out of his ass. The echoes from below caused an uproar of splashing, and sweat began to bead on his forehead. After an eternity of releasing his bowels, Skeeter finally rose and searched for some toilet paper out of the dispenser, but found none. He spat as he pulled up his pants and zipped up his fly. He returned to his area and continued his work. During lunch break, one of the young bucks came out of the port-a-john screaming, "Who blew up the crapper? And why the hell are there a bunch of maggots wiggling around the turds?" Skeeter said nothing as he felt the gurgling of his stomach. He panicked inside, thinking that the worms came from him. He felt sick and no longer wanted to be at work. All he wanted to do was leave and drink himself into a blackout. Skeeter was able to push through the 10 hours and was finally home. He walked into his bedroom and saw that the spot where he killed the worms was still there, a nasty stain left in the center of the bed. The image resurfaced of them rolling in his sweat, and he scratched at his arms. He lifted up the mattress and flipped it over so he'd no longer have to look at it. He didn't bother putting any blankets or pillows in the bed. Instead, he walked out and drove toward Gino's. After a few threats of a beep down, the owner let Skeeter in to drink all night. No one sat near him after what had happened the other night, but they also didn't mention the incident of him spewing chunks and crapping himself. He didn't mind and preferred to sit alone, trying to drown out the thoughts of the nasty things he had dealt with. Soon, a foggy glaze covered his sight, and the warmth of the liquor gave him a bit of comfort. A few $100 later, he made his way back home to watch TV and sit in his chair. He stopped to get a pack of cigarettes and a 12-pack of beer before going home. Making sure he had what he needed to enjoy the rest of the night, he ate wings at Gino's so he didn't need to worry about food. He stared at the TV, which was playing some oddball comedy in the wee hours of the night, and he felt his eyes getting heavy. Skeeter contemplated calling off work as he scratched at every surface of the skin that burned. Sleep began to take him over, and eventually he passed out in the chair. The generator ran itself dry, leaving the trailer silent, with the flame of his lantern the only thing illuminating the spot where the man slept. Skeeter screamed with immense pain shooting at the bottom of his stomach. He rose up from his chair and ran out of the doors toward the woods, sunlight breaking above the treetops. He knelt down to a squatting position with his pants around his ankles and wailed as he let the content of his stomach exit out of his lower half. The burn from the experience was unbearable. He prayed it would all stop. After a few minutes, the flow of excrement stopped its exit. He stood up, afraid to look, but did it anyway. A large puddle of brown and red, and at the center was a squirming pile of white maggots. The pile consisted of those same maggot-like worms, but this time it was triple in size, and the things were spreading faster, with some burrowing into the ground. Skeeter couldn't handle looking at his own filth and ran back to his trailer. He sat in the corner of his living room, his knees pressed up against his chest as he rocked back and forth. "What's going on? What's wrong with me?" He remained like this for half an hour before he got up to search around for his cigarettes. He lit one up and the sensation of his stomach returned. "No, not again, please." The gurgling was painful and his mouth began to water, drool running out and spilling onto his beard. He could feel something in his stomach moving around, tiny shifting sensations that tickled different areas within his stomach. He wanted to push his hand into his insides and stop the feeling. It made him nauseous as he imagined those creepy crawlers wiggling around inside of him. The movement in his belly caused him to feel like he was going to vomit or crap himself, and he scrambled to the cooler in search of a beer. That was his answer to everything. Any problem could be solved with alcohol. He cracked open the warm can and chugged the piss-warm liquid until there was nothing left. A loud belch erupted from his belly, and a burn hit his throat. And soon the gurgling got worse along with the internal squirming of his guts. Oh no. He couldn't stop it now. Something was going to exit his body. He ran out and before making it past the door, Skeeter began to vomit the beer he'd just chugged. Snot and tears fell from his face to mix with the liquid and bile that hit the ground, regret filling his mind with every heave. White throbbing worms joined in the mixture that expelled from his mouth. The whole experience was gut-wrenching, and he could feel liquid running down his leg. Soon, sharp stings pecked at the wet portions of his legs. Skeeter rushed inside to remove his pants in hopes to stop the pinching. His legs were wet with piss, and tiny red spots littered his flesh all over. He looked down at his pants and more of those little, small, white things were squirming off the folded denim and dropping on the dingy carpet. "What the?" His words, pausing with slow burps in between. He removed the rest of his clothes until he was only in his underwear. Skeeter took his jeans and threw them outside and they landed on the pool of vomit and worms that were spreading and making their way back toward the opening of the trailer. He yelped when he felt more stinging on his unmentionable areas. The center of his underwear was still soaked in his urine, and he could feel things moving around. He panicked and ripped the stained garment off and tossed it outside as well. He rushed to his room and pulled out clothing from a pile, dressing in haste. In a few moments, he was in his truck and headed to the nearest store. The entire drive, all he felt was the burning of his skin that itched like crazy, and he almost ran off the road as he tried to scratch at his legs. While at the store, he bought 4 jugs of water, a bottle of whiskey, a 6-pack of beer, and a pack of cigarettes. When he made it back home, he dumped the 3 jugs into the tub in the bathroom and poured bleach in the water. He poured a bit of dish soap into the mix and using a last jug to dump it in to stir up the concoction. He placed the alcohol and cigarettes at the edge of the tub before removing his clothes and slowly descending into the water. As he placed himself at the bottom of the tub, A jolt of electricity hit his body from the cold of the water. He began to take handfuls of liquid and splash it all over his itching body. The bleach in the water started to burn. The growing red spots had covered his leg and genitals. After dousing his wounds, Skeeter popped the top of the whiskey and began to drink. The harsh liquid filled his stomach and he felt the comforting burn. He gagged a little as he set the bottle down. He lit up a cigarette and let himself soak for a while. More pain shot from his body and he looked down at his legs. Blood was leaking out from every spot, and it seemed that the tiny specks had now become holes the size of a pencil eraser. The pain increased, and Skeeter drank more in hopes that it would numb the pain. Soon the bottle was gone and half of the beer had been finished. With a burning cigarette between his fingers, Skeeter began to doze off. The alcohol had done its job and left the sensation of pain to lift and fade. Moments later, he was asleep, but the slumber lasted mere minutes before he abruptly awoke. A searing ache infected his skin, and the unsettling movements in his stomach returned. The cigarette fell into the water and died with a hiss as it became soaked in the tub. He panicked, thinking the cherry would burn him, but he rushed his hands to grab the butt. He was relieved after realizing the water had put it out. But he noticed the tub was now filled with a red liquid. The spots on his body now resembled massive zits, with pulsating white heads at the surface that were expanding out of his flesh. They burned like hell, and he soon began to try and squeeze out the pus. Skeeter swore between clenched teeth as he used his fingers to squeeze each end of the nasty, acne-like whelps. No pus exploded from the spot, and he felt movement under the section of skin he was squeezing on. He bit his lip as he took his long and dirt-encrusted nail to rip open the stubborn zit. To his horror, when he did so, there was a fat, wriggling white maggot that was ripped open from the open sore. Anxiety riddled his body and he felt vomit rushing to the back of his throat. In a fit of panic and frustration, Skeeter scratched at every inch of his infected body, releasing an army of those white parasites. When they dropped into the water, they began to squirm their way to the surface. Skeeter stood up and continued his flurry of self-mutilation until every white spot had been removed from the sores. He hopped out to look at the tub filled with a school of white maggots shifting around in the diluted blood pool. The sight was disgusting. The thought of these things coming out of his body made him lightheaded, and his blood ran cold. His stomach churned and began to retch without any time to stop it. A dark green liquid hurled from his mouth into the tub and mixed, adding even more white forms to join the mass. Hundreds of them had taken over the tub and were floating. Skeeter wiped his face and beard before putting his clothes back on, the fabric stinging the open sores of his legs and genitals. He started to walk out and paused to look at himself in the mirror. He was pale. His eyes were completely encased in busted blood vessels. Tears of red began to fall as he looked closer. His eyeballs were growing out of their sockets. The orbs continued to grow in size, slowly popping out beyond the lids. Small holes formed around the cornea. White specks were jutting out of the red, and soon small fibers burst outward in a flurry that covered his face. Screams echoed from the trailer as Skeeter clawed at his face. The more he dug, the more blood fell to the sink, and with it came slender versions of the white maggots that were floating in the tub. These ones resembled the kind you find when deworming a puppy. Long and thin creatures that rolled around in crimson puddle that settled in the sink. The pain he was inflicting on himself sent jolts of fire to burn in his skull, but the feeling of those things moving around in his eyes was worse. In a sheer force of will, he forced his fingers into his eye sockets and pulled out the hole-ridden spheres one at a time, throwing them blindly down on the floor and stomping on them with his bare feet. He saw only black, but could feel the constant flow of blood and worms falling from the vacant holes in his face. The pain radiated, and he felt more movement in every portion of his body. small shifting pulses under his skin that traveled everywhere, and he could feel his hair falling from the follicles and replaced with more slender worms that pushed themselves out. He was sweating as he cried and dropped to his knees. As the beads of sweat forced their way through his pores, he could feel small, wiggling things pushed out with the perspiration. He rubbed his hand across his face, and when he brought his hand down in his palm, there could be felt a dozen squirming forms moving across his skin. "Why?" Skeeter muttered to himself before falling flat on the floor. A shifting inside his stomach attacked him with severe nausea and greater amounts of pain. It felt like a snake was roaming around inside of his intestines, with little babies hatching out of eggs and biting at his insides. The gurgling returned, and he began to spew vomit that coated his beard with fluid and things that burrowed under the hair. His bowels let loose, and he felt a snake-like creature coil inside his gut. Pain radiated on every spot of his body, and Skeeter begged any god that was listening to help him, but his prayer was not answered as he felt a tear at his belly. The creature was writhing violently, and it felt it chew at his guts until a head burst through the skin. Soon, another massive form forced itself out of his rectum in a burst of blood and filth. Skeeter screamed in agony, but the sound was quickly stifled by another large and bulbous mass shooting from his throat and out of his mouth. His body gave way to a dozen large creatures that emerged from every orifice. Fat, corrugated grubs the size of pythons, white with green and yellow spots covering the tops of their restless bodies, surrounded Skeeter. During the night, Skeeter's corpse released a plague of those hideous creatures. Forms of every length and girth escaped, and soon the ones in the tub had grown long enough to slide out and shimmy toward the center of the bathroom. Gleaming black fangs protruded out of an open end of the larger ones that had burst out of Skeeter's skin while he was still alive. A set of four at each side of the circular opening, the worms drove these things into the flesh and consumed the leftover fluids before devouring the muscle tissue. Medium-sized ones burrowed through the flesh to eat the remnants of the internal organs. The walls of the trailer were filled with a sickening sound of chewing, followed by loud crunching. The man's skin and bones had been broken down to mush by the largest of the white abominations, while the smaller, maggot-sized parasites slurped up the leftovers of his body. By morning, nothing remained of the man except for the clothes he was wearing that were torn to shreds. The destroyed fabrics were surrounded by blood, feces, vomit, and slender trails of yellow slime. It would be a week before anyone checked on Skeeter. They found his clothes and the tub full of blood, but no sign of the man or the disgusting things that his body had incubated. No real investigation was done. There was no sign of a break-in. But there was a strange trail of blood that led out of the bathroom toward the front door. The people in town chalked it up to a bad fight or an animal attack, but with Skeeter's reputation, no one went out of their way to find him. In fact, most of the people rejoiced at the notion that the dirty monster had finally left him and their town for good. I hope you enjoyed Don't Drink the Worm by Michael Mann, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented featured author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Michael-Mann. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/MICHAEL-MANN. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. And once again, I'd like to give a nice big thank you to all of tonight's featured authors. Now, before we go, I would also like to take a moment to thank you personally for joining me here on this episode of Scary Stories Told in the Dark. If you enjoyed what you've heard on today's program, please take a moment to stop by our iTunes page or wherever else you listen to your favorite podcasts and leave us a 5-star review and a kind word. It makes a huge difference and would mean a lot to us. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all of our latest updates and new releases and have the chance to interact with us each and every week. You can subscribe to me on YouTube as well at the Otis Gyre channel, where you'll find releases of my series, Horror Storytime, dating back 10 years to 2014. And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram too. Just search for Otis Gyre. Until next week, stay spooky and get some sleep, if you can.
Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com today to learn more about our network and our other amazing storytelling programs. Tonight's program was hosted, and its featured stories, performed by yours truly, Otis Gyre. Selected stories have been adapted with the kind permission of their respective authors. Original music provided by Luke Hodgkinson and Jesse Cornett. Sound design and final mixing and mastering provided by executive producer and director Craig Groshek. Program's artwork and logo by David Romero. If you're looking for some fresh tales on a daily basis while waiting for the next podcast, check out my YouTube channel, the Otis Gyre channel, and my extensive collection of narrated tales there. Simply search on YouTube by my name and you'll find me. And don't forget to subscribe and press the bell notification icon to get my latest releases. Got a scary tale of your own that you'd like performed? I take submissions. Email it to me today at otis@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your terrifying tome considered for production in a future episode of this show. That's otis@simplyscarypodcast.com. If you've enjoyed what you heard on tonight's program and are joining us on your favorite podcast app, subscribe to us to be sure you never miss an episode and leave a 5-star review and a comment. Your feedback means a lot to me. You can also follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and yours truly on Facebook to connect anytime and get the latest updates on this and other programs and my channel. If you're listening on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, do us a favor and hit the subscribe button and the bell notification icon for CTFDN as well to get more spooky tales from me and the crew and another episode of this program each and every Wednesday. And don't forget to hit that thumbs up button to tell us how we're doing and leave a kind word or a request. And don't forget to visit us at chillingtalesfordarknights.com and consider supporting the team by becoming a patron. In addition to helping us out, you'll get exclusive access to our audio archive and ad-free downloads of all your favorite stories, including those you've heard on this program. As for me, I'll be back next Wednesday with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. But that's all right. Who needs sleep anyway?